everybody. Welcome to another edition of Second Sunday Books. I'm Libby Hellman, your host. And tonight's edition is going to be a little bit different. My guest, as you can see, is Judith Starkson. Like me, she writes historical fiction, and her new book of Kings and Griffins came out about a week after Bend in the River. So we thought we'd get together and talk about historical fiction and why we write it and how it's a little bit different for us and what goes into it, as well as tell you about our books. So before I start, I just need you to know that this is a trademark copyrighted podcast, which is solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Okay, welcome, Judith. Thank you for being here. This is going to be fun. So tell me about, Of Kings and Griffins. What is it?
It is my fiction is set in the Bronze Age of the sort of Eastern Mediterranean, the Hittite Empire. So long ago, and as you notice from Griffins in the title, it has some fantastical elements, which were part of that culture. So I, you know, all good historical fiction is grounded in a very concrete world. And all good fantasy is grounded in a very clear sense of set of rules for the fantastical elements. And so I bring those to really together. Know,
what is a griffin?
A griffin is a creature that is, the body is a lion with big, you know, feline paws and pouncing. And the head is an eagle with a very large and vicious looking beak that can, you know, sort of like a sword. And then it has huge wings. And it was such a regal creature in the imaginations of all of these ancient kingdoms around the Mediterranean. We see them on the thrones, behind the thrones, painted on the walls, and in on their seal rings, with they would, you know, sign their name, there would be a griffin. So they're this rather common iconic image that is very much part of this world.
Are they evil, or are they good, or they have their moods like everybody else?
Well, the fun thing for me is that there is very little mythology, although they're constantly in the iconography. Unlike so much in the ancient world, there's not so much mythology about them. So I got to build the whole land of the griffins and the character and nature of a griffin. And my griffins they're not fond of human beings. I'll just say that. And in my series, they need something from some human beings. So there's interaction, but it is always tense.
Oh, really?
And yet they're rather lovable once you get, like a cat. You know how cats have their own agenda,
right?
But don't mess with them. And then they might curl up in your lap. So, in some ways, they're like that.
What's the story of this book, if you can do it in a few less than?
Well, my sort of quick log line is a vicious king, vengeful griffins, and a scheming goddess. And if you take all three of those and you put them, they are the sort of skeleton of the plot. My main character, whose name is Tesha, is a queen of and at the point of this book in my series, and each of them works perfectly well as a standalone, but at this point in her historic career, she is the queen of a small, extremely unstable, fractious kingdom in the north of this large world power known as the Hittite Empire. In my fiction, because I write just enough fantastical elements, I changed the Hittites to Hittolia. Like, you're meant to know it's the Hittites. But in case you thought I was trying to, you know, convince you that griffins really walked the earth or something and you'd get crabby about it, I call it Hittolia. So,
but you have a bad.
So anyway.
You have a real background in writing historical fiction. I mean, you majored in history, didn't you?
I'm a classicist by my original training. So Greek was my sort of primary linguistic background in literature and history. And I started on the Hittites. I, I have to say, the Hittites are this culture that got totally buried, literally buried and forgotten. There are some other people called Hittites in the Bible. So everyone always goes, oh, that. No, those are not the same people at all. Those are called Neo-Hittites now because they sort of stole the name. You know, it'd be like, I don't know, Cleveland was the only part of the United States that left, that was surviving, and they called themselves the United States. So they were like this little subset. But in any case, that I got started because I was writing a novel set in the Trojan War, and that's the same historical period. And the Trojans were actually on the western edge of the part of the Hittite Empire. So, and while I was researching their culture, I found this queen and I just fell in love with her. Like, excuse me, she is in this very patriarchal world and she was the most respected and honored, and everybody just did what she said eventually. Like, it took her a long time to get there, but she, no one messed with Tesha. Her name was actually Puduhepa, but like, I'm sorry, Puduhepa. She needed a new name.
There's some similarities that I can see. I'm writing about a very contentious period in Vietnamese history, the Vietnam War. My characters are all human, but they feature two sisters that you can sort of see in the cover poster behind me. And they have major conflicts with each other. In fact, they become estranged from each other for 10 years of the war because they're such different people. And there are also some women heroes or female characters that are, you know, not like your Tesha, but close. There was a woman in the book, a character who really did exist. She was a doctor and she worked for the South Vietnamese government, but she was a closeted communist. And so she probably was a spy. And I discovered her in Stanley Karnow's history, excellent. It was Vietnam history. And he had interviewed her. She was still alive. She renounced communism toward the end of her life. She recruits one of the sisters to fight for the Viet Cong. So.
Yeah, I really enjoyed Bend in the River, and I was reading it and I thought, oh yeah, there are lots. I mean, there's so many millennia between us. And yet, that whole idea of a homeland or a place that's yours, exactly. Is very much a tension in who gets to claim this piece of land, which, you know, we just keep going back to that over and over, is very central to what I write about also.
And it's also part of the structure of fiction that you must have conflict, you know, even if it's only a person wanting a glass of water and they can't get it, you know?
Yeah.
So what did people say when you first brought out your first novel and you were mixing fantasy and historical fiction? Were there any people who said, oh, come on, you can't do that. You've got to do one or the other.
Well, there are definitely people in the historical fiction community who just get frantic anytime you introduce any fantastical elements. And I actually, in my very first novel, which wasn't about the Hittites, except that it was about Troy, I mean, it's set in the context of the Iliad. So, you know, Achilles' mother is a goddess and I have her walk right on stage because that's what the tradition says. That's what the Greeks thought. And to me, that was totally historical fiction. That wasn't fantasy. So I didn't describe myself as writing fantasy. And then people reacted and they were like, oh my gosh, you can't have goddesses alive and well in your novel and have that be historical fiction. You write fantasy. I'm like, okay, I write fantasy then, whatever, you can call it what you like. But, and I have gotten more and more, clearly griffins as a character, and they don't just, they don't just like stomp around with their big kitty paws. They communicate. They have a, it's a sort of telepathic way of, so they have a complete language that my characters who are human, just one, can actually communicate. So they're real characters. So I will totally recognize that as fantasy, you know, like they did exist.
why historical fiction as opposed to contemporary?
You know, I find when I read a modern thriller or something and terrible things are happening, you know, like we so often have violence against women in the, you know, I just get edgy and uncomfortable. But when there's violence or conflict or all these things that make for good fiction in a world somewhat removed from right now, mm-hmm. I find I can think about it and I can process it and it doesn't make me feel miserable. It makes me feel engaged. And I love, I mean, I really love the ancient world. I just think.
Why do you love it so much?
Well, partly because it isn't, there's a richness to it. I mean, for example, in a really early scene in Of Kings and Griffins, you know, we're right now in the United States trying to pick our next leader by voting. Everybody go vote. They use divinations to decide. So that's so different. Like, it's so exotic. It's so bizarre to us, which is intrinsically engaging. And yet, when you really start going into the mechanics of that and the effect of it, and then, you know, we writers are, I think some, is it David Corbett? Somebody says, we're just adults who never gave up our imaginary friends. So, you know, we sit there with our imaginary friends doing and live this. So when you live picking a leader by divination instead of by election, the psychological insights that come, because it's just a step removed, you know, it's not the current political mess that we're so, you know, wrought with, but it's similar themes.
Removed, a few steps removed.
So I think it's a way of getting at truth and opening minds and enjoying yourself while you're doing that instead of feeling stressed out and miserable. So I just think that my fiction gives people, you know, all the best of human crisis without the stress, I guess.
I understand completely. My approach is a little different. I also studied history in college. And then I worked in broadcast news, which is history in the making.
Right.
And I am amazed that mankind and womankind keep making the same mistakes over and over and over. And the idea of history repeating itself is so true to me. And there may be one or two little factors that make it different than the cycle that was previous to it, but basically human nature hasn't changed. Our aggression, the aggression inside us hasn't changed. The manipulation hasn't changed in eons. And I just feel compelled to tell those stories when I find them. And I do take things a little bit too extreme. I mean, my conflict, when I talk conflict, it's usually in the context of a war or a revolution, because I think that that helps me draw characters. It helps me create characters that have to deal with a lot of different layers of conflicts, all the way from artifice to existential conflict, whether they're going to live or die. And it always surprises me which person is going to turn out to be a hero and which person is going to turn out to be a coward. And that part of it I love. This, though, you know, the previous historicals I've written have also been thrillers, like yours are historicals and fantasies. Mine were thrillers, but this is the first one that's straight historical fiction. I can't call it a mystery. I can't really call it a thriller, although I think that there is some inherent suspense when you track the characters and the characters are trying to overcome obstacles, which of course is a staple of suspense, is how they deal with obstacles. So I guess, and the other thing is I like recent history. I'm not called to do ancient history. I like 20th century history. I'll go back to, the furthest I've gone back to write about is World War II. So as I get older and more history is available, because, they say it's not a historical unless 50 years have passed, suddenly there's all sorts of things I can write about.
I think I first got to know you when the book you were publishing was set in the Iranian revolution. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and I think there's, I think you're right about a bend in the river, that it's not a thriller in that sense. It's much more the growth of both these sisters, but they're in counterpoint to each other because they both are so different. So I think the richness of it comes from that, the different paths they take, and then it allows you to celebrate the ambiguity of the rights, wrongs, goods, bads, all of those things, which it happens somewhat more gradually in my overall series. The first book in my series, the great enemy, the people that they are fighting against, who actually use guerrilla warfare. It's not called that. Nobody knew that. But we have that commonality too. They are seen in pretty, not black and white, but they're seen as bad by, the characters fighting, because they haven't actually interacted. They haven't come to know each other. Yeah.
They're strange.
And over the course of the series, so by this book, I won't spoil the ending, but there's a lot of gray.
Changes. Okay.
Villains are not always if you villainize a people, that doesn't hold for long, that's never gonna work.
Exactly right, which is one of the other reasons I felt compelled to tell it from the Vietnamese side. Although I will say that, like you, when you got feedback that you shouldn't mix history and fantasy, I got feedback that I'm a white woman, so what am I doing writing about an ethnicity of which I do not have a single drop of blood?
Yeah,
I felt compelled to tell the story of Vietnamese sisters because of most of the literature about Vietnam is told from the American perspective, US perspective. We're on the US side, and it's beginning to change. The Sympathizer came out, maybe that was 10 years ago. And there's been a few more books that have come out. The Mountain Sing is a new one that came out, and there's another new one that came out. And Fire Road was a really good story about the woman who, that iconic picture of the little girl running down the road when she's been burned by napalm. Well, she's now 50-ish, in her 50s, and she wrote a book about the whole experience. It changed her life. Sure. And I met her when she came to Chicago to do a signing when I was still writing this book. And it was really fun to kind of talk to her and get some feedback from her about what things were like. It's a great book too. Anyway, so what is the hardest thing for you to do when you're writing historical fiction or any kind of fiction?
I guess partly for me, because the sources that I draw on are, you got to interview people and read newspapers and, have contemporary accounts. So for you, it's, I guess probably one of your challenges is that there's just so much information that it's winnowing it down to just what you need to be clear. For me, there are these huge gaps in what we know. So I have to fill those in possibly. Even though I have
the gaps because people weren't literate. The people weren't literate.
Oh no, it was illiterate. It was a literate culture, but we're talking the 13th century BCE. What they wrote on was clay. You would think clay would survive beautifully, but if it's not fired, it just doesn't. And only a few things get fired for preservation. And so the main big libraries that we have are rather circumstantial because they're in a city where the entire city turned into a kiln when it was destroyed in war. And then whatever archive there was preserved. So there's it's partly that the preservation of the texts is rather random. And then they come to us in rather fragmentary form. And then just to add another layer, they wrote in cuneiform, which was a writing system. You know, it's those little bird tracks, those little triangles that all form together. And that was a writing system first used for the Semitic language of Sumerian, like a good, you know, generations before the Hittites were ever trying to use it. So it's an old language that they then adapt to Hittite is basically a form of Greek. I can muddle around in the discussion of it. I can't translate it, but my classics background serves me well because it's a similar language, which makes it absolutely different from the language that this writing system was developed for. So you try and translate it and ay, ay, ay. So there are all these things that create barriers to thoroughness of understanding. And so I collect all this information and try and then I just eventually have to stuff that into my brain, put it aside, and then let that imaginary friend, that priestess or that queen or, you know, that... in essence, guerrilla fighter, come alive and do what they're going to say, you know, do what they're going to do, say what they're going to say. And all that information I've loaded in informs that, but doesn't impede it. And I guess can be a slow project, getting all of those things in place.
Yeah. I had to let this sit by itself for about 3 or 4 months after I wrote the first draft to go back and update it and revise it because of that. One of the things that I think changed my life and gave me the courage to do this kind of historical work is when I was a senior in high school and was in an AP class and discovered there was something called historiography. That people could write different interpretations of history. And So, you know, just because fact is a fact didn't mean that something, you know, it could be interpreted differently. So that helped me, you know, as I'm writing my own version of history in each of these thrillers about what's going on. But, you know, I at the same time, I have to be authentic to the characters and they've got to do what they've got to do, just like yours have to do what yours do. I was going to say, for me, the absolute fun part is the research though, because of exactly what you said, I get to watch movies, I get to read articles, I get to read books. I look online for newsreels and things like that. And I take a lot of my information from there. And for this book, you know, I went to Vietnam, but I also had to do enormous amounts of research after I got back to fill in. And I'd come across nuggets. You know, I thought I knew the Vietnam War. I mean, I knew it from the Western perspective because you know, I was demonstrating against it and things like that. I knew nothing. Yeah. And every time I discovered a nugget that I didn't know about, I said, wow, that's really fascinating. I wonder if other people don't know that and maybe they'd be interested in it. So in parts of the book, you know, the Cooch Tunnels, for example, which happened to probably be the biggest tourist attraction in Vietnam, you know, when people, which was the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong lived in the tunnels to avoid the American air attacks. You know, they would stay in there for weeks, sometimes a month. You know, the bar girls in Saigon loved being bar girls because they were kind of the first liberated women of Vietnam. They could choose what man they wanted to be with, if they even wanted to be with a man. They were not forced to. They were not theoretically in a brothel or anything like that. And they loved American GIs because the Americans were so polite and respectful to them. So all of these little nuggets really, I felt, peppered the book, and I was really glad that I knew about it, you know, that yeah. I discovered them. So anyway, so what is the easiest thing? I asked you what the hardest thing is. What's the easiest part of writing
for you? You know, interestingly enough, I find when I think of as shifting entirely into fantasy mode. So that I just have a blast because then, so for example, I also have a sisters in my, throughout the series, but it's particularly the case in this book. And one of the, Tesha is the sort of main character, but her sister, Danita, is blind. So that's an interesting quality. And she's also over time discovered that Tesha was the one that people realized was magic or had magical abilities fairly early on, in, at least in my series. She was a priestess in historical times who did these rites that were magic. We would call them magic, and she fully believed that she could, you know, remove a curse. If somebody cursed you and made you ill, she could remove it and get you better. Like that was not a negotiable concept. She was sure that was true. So I just take these historical nuggets, as you call them, that they are, and develop it. It's true. The kinds of curses she can undo and that get put on her, you know, her family, et cetera, are much grander than probably historically they discussed. I'll admit it, but storytelling is way more fun. But I have fun when I go into full fantasy mode, and the sister, Danita, is the one who can interact with the griffins.
Oh, because the blindness give her an extra.
Actually, she has a kind of telepathic ability, mm-hmm. And she certainly has a sensitivity to other modes of communicating other than through sight. You know, like she doesn't. But this is sort of this is her capacity that it's not necessarily tied to her being blind. I try not to write. When I first started writing her as a blind character, I did a tremendous amount of reading and exploring and talking to the members of the blind community. This character echolocates and other kinds of things that are absolutely the way, you know, a lot of blind people navigate through the world. And I just adopted that. But that then led... That took me down a road of fantasy very easily.
Yeah.
So,
I usually complain and whine that I hate writing, that it is the hardest thing I've ever done. And it's true, to write a good book is really, really hard. But I really enjoyed writing this. And I think it's because I didn't have the pressure of the plot on my back, like you do in a mystery where it's very structured and you have to have one clue here and one clue there. And then you have to reveal maybe a red herring. You know, I didn't have to remember to do that. I could just write the characters and I could stay in their heads for not a long time, but until I got it right. And I've never, a friend of mine called it much more organic. And I really think that's the truth. So before we go, and I want to show everyone a picture of your cover.
Okay.
And hopefully we're looking at it now. It is one of the most gorgeous covers I have ever seen. And you said there was a story about it. Tell me.
Well, the cover artist that I hire, and when she did the first two covers of this series, you know, we started with a young woman and we actually took heads off and legs off. I'm sure the FBI have me in some file because I'd say, no, you know, that's not quite the arm position I want. Can we do this? So we were lopping off limbs. So I thought when I said, well, I want a griffin on this new cover. Well, you know, I know she works from photographs, you know, like the parts are photos, that she'd just, you know, take a eagle head and glue it on a lion or something. I don't know. I am not a graphic artist and I don't have these skills. She's like, oh gosh, this is going to be really hard. Like, when I take one arm off, I can only put certain arms on that are going to follow that angle. And lion bodies just don't do the eagle angle and they don't fly. So we went through this whole stage of there's something called 3D art, which is kind of like a skeleton that they can, they can make it move. They can change the position in an organic way. So we were going to do that. But unfortunately, the woman who was making these 3D griffins that she was going to use as a base, there are griffins and then there are griffins. Mine are the ancient world griffins. And as I said, they have these big lion bodies and feet and, you know, and the feline thing is part of them. Well, the medieval griffin that you see on the hair, like on their coats of arms and all, are much more birdy. Like they have claws that are talons and they're scrawny bodied and they're just not my griffins. Well, that's what she was making. So I was like, oh, darn. So, so we went through more permutations and finally found like a body that would look, you know, like you could put all these parts together and it works.
It was perfect. Oh my God. Let's do it again. Just one more time. Okay, you can see it right there. Okay, very quickly, because we're running out of time. What's next for you?
Well, at the end of this book, there is a very satisfying resolution, but built into it, as the readers will find, are suggestions that this is a, you know, the battle has been won, but there is still a war to come. And this is a big Mediterranean world that Tessa lives in, and at this moment she only rules over a very small part of it. Maybe that's not entirely the case forever.
My God, I love that. I have no idea what I'm going to write next. I was lucky. I published two books this year, one in the summer and then this one. And I'm giving myself a rest and hopefully I'm going to come up with another idea. I don't know if I'm going to go back to my series or if I'm going to write another historical. I'd like to write another historical because it was so much fun. But I know there people are saying, oh, you got to go back to Ellie. You got to go back to Georgia, whatever. I don't know. So that's where we're at. Anyway, yep. Judith, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thank you.
Oh, no, it was my pleasure to really just get into it with another person who adores writing historical fiction. And I hope all of you enjoyed it, too. And I hope that you will be back next month where I will be interviewing Les Edgerton. He's got a new book called Hard Times. And boy, is it interesting. That will be fun for all of us. So for now, thanks for watching or listening, and I will talk to you next month. So long.